Hi, and welcome to this week's VFX show. I'm Mike Seymour, joined by a couple of Matts, starting with Matt Walden. How are you, sir?
Great. Hanging out here in Virginia.
And slightly closer to home, or at least closer to my home, is Matt Graham. How are you, Matt?
Oh, I'm very good, thank you.
Now, I'm sorry about the slight delay in getting out this. I will confess that it was my fault. We had a film that got into Cannes. I had to suddenly drop everything and work on that because we didn't expect it to get into Cannes. 3,500 films got entered, and I make 9 accepted, and we were one of them, and we didn't expect that. So as a consequence, I sort of drop everything and postpone almost everything else that I was doing to work on that film. But that's in now, so we're back, and we have a good bunch of shows for you guys coming up. Not only do we have this week the film AI, which I like to think of basically as a mecha masterpiece, but also coming up we have Thor, we have stuff to do with some more retro things, including Poltergeist, and of course big season films like Pirates all coming up here on the VFX show. So let's start, as we do, with a quick rundown of what we think of the film before we get into the visual effects for this retro look at AI. And I'll start with you, Matt Graham. Did you enjoy the film?
I did in bits. I think second time watching, I haven't watched it since it first came out many moons ago, but I found it quite slow and boring and just odd when I first saw it. And this time I appreciate it a lot more, mostly because many years going by and having a better appreciation for the technical way it was achieved, I really dug it. And it was nice to sit back and absorb some of that stuff in.
I must admit, one of the things I did when I watched it again recently was struck by how many cameos there were in it. I guess the first time out, I was into the film. The second, the more recent time, I just was watching it with a different eye. And I suddenly became aware of a whole lot of people. Obviously, I noticed Robin Williams the first time as Dr. No, but Chris Rock, Meryl Streep, Ben Kinsley. I mean, I was like, really? I hadn't noticed all these people around. What did you think, Matt? Matt Walden?
Yeah, I mean, I would say the same. I mean, I kind of feel like I have a complicated sort of a love-hate relationship with this movie. There's a lot of things about it that I really do like, that I think work really well. But I do have some problems with certain aspects of it. But I think the overarching theme of the film, I think what they're the questions that are being posited in the film are ones that I find really intriguing, and so that I would say I come down on the side of liking the film overall, just for that reason alone.
Now, was your problem centered around a 2,000-year jump by any chance?
No, not really. My problem was more with some. It's kind of nitpicky, but it was with some of the art direction. There were some.
Oh, really?
Yeah, there were some art direction things that I had problems with. And one of the other things that I had a hard time getting past, and I remember feeling this way when I watched the film, but I wasn't conscious of it, of the facts of this. But all the interiors of their house, it always felt really the family's house where the film, a huge part of the film takes place, or at least the first act of the film. It felt really hermetic to me, and I could never figure out, God, why does that place seem so weird? It felt like, you're in like an IKEA or something. And it turns out that was all sets, and it was all shot in, it's all built and it's all actually inside, and it felt inside. And that was something that, really it bothered me in a way that it doesn't bother me in a lot of films, but it really, it stood out somehow.
Actually, I have to agree with you, that set did bother me as well, and it was custom-built inside a soundstage. In fact, it was custom-built inside a soundstage so that they could actually have sort of a dummy layer between the floors so the puppeteers could work. So, in fact, it was incredibly elaborate set, two-story set, but allowing the puppeteers to get underneath to do a lot of stuff that was needed. I guess my thing, at the time, I remember this really distinctly, I had a problem with the 2,000-year jump. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's any film we've reviewed on the VFX show that is more a three-act story than this. I mean, this is like so incredibly three films. There's the initial, section where it's on the in the house. There's the on-the-run, in-the-wild kind of section, and then obviously there's the future section. And they're so distinctive, it's incredible. But yes, that first one did feel weird and kind of claustrophobic. And yet, I think there's one huge thing that they could have done. He offering advice to, you know, multi-Academy Award-winning Steven Spielberg. But there's one thing that it could have done for me. You know, the very opening of the film, there's a like a setup, a voiceover, mm-hmm. discussing kind of the history. That is Ben Kingsley, who obviously is the specialist evolved mecha at the end. If we'd got more of a taste of that being some voice from the future, something that was more of a precursor, so that I didn't feel that the jump 2,000 years came out of nowhere, but in fact, like there's a dumb device. Matt Graham, do you remember in Mad Max, one of the Mad Max, I can't remember which it was, but there's this great bit where there's a voiceover and it's told from the future, and at the end of it, I think it's Mad Max 2, you realize that it was the voice of the boy who'd been with Mad
yeah.
Max.
Yeah,
and in that, you kind of forgot about the voice at the beginning until at the end when you connected it back to the dots, because, I don't know, for some reason I'm stupid or audiences just forget things, but if you'd sort of established some voice from the future at the very beginning, I'm sure I would have, like, then kind of forgotten about it in the movie, and then that would have given me closure at the end, but it really felt like the jump 2000 came out of nowhere for me, even though it was, in fact, Ben Kingsley's voice at the beginning. Did that apply for you?
No, for me, I kind of went along with that, but I definitely felt a lot of the film was claustrophobic, even the bits in the wild and when they go down to the city. I don't know, you don't have that many wide shots in the film, do you, until you really get to the end where it's all CG.
Yeah.
It's apart from that, you are really stuck in a confined studio space.
I was confused, too, in the sequence at the end when I first saw the film. I wasn't aware of the fact that those beings were supposed to be like the, you know, evolved sort of mecha creatures. They you know, immediately you see those forms and that sort of the art, you know, the concept design of those figures, and immediately for me I just thought, oh, they're aliens, and I'm like, well, what's going on here? Like, all of a sudden there's aliens on the planet, and it wasn't clear to me at first. That was another sort of art direction thing that I had a problem with. You know,
is that the creatures at the end?
Yeah, like I thought they were aliens, I didn't realize that they're supposed to be. Same. You know, they're supposed to be like future, like super mechas. You know.
Yeah. You guys didn't get that?
I started drifting near the end. Just come on, get to the fireworks factory. I mean, I think the animation of those creatures is awesome to keep you interested without having any faces and stuff, but I didn't pick that they were mechas.
Man, I'm the exact opposite. I thought the animation was poor by today's standards, that it felt very keyframey, clunky. But if you agree that they had emotion without the faces.
But if you look at the context of when it was, though, I mean, there's a lot of things. Though?
Like 2001 is, I don't know. No, I don't think that was the finest part of it. There's obviously four big animation character animations, those being the Blue Fairy, Dr. No, and Teddy, but I think Teddy's stuff was vastly better, or even
Teddy was definitely better, but then again a lot of Teddy was practical. Yeah.
I think for me, actually, one thing I wanted to get before we get too heavily into visual effects, do you guys actually remember when this film came out? Because I remember really distinctly I was a flame artist full time, and the web was around, and it was one of the first movies that I remember having a really advanced web campaign before the film came out. And what happened is that in the weeks and months before the film came out, they started putting up fake websites for, like, the various people in the film and back characters of people in the film. Hmm. And, like, if you could really, like, research it, you could spend hours getting, like, you go to a fake research paper that would be listed from the Cybertronics Inc. New Jersey company, and then if you sort of would go there, you'd get a link to a, you know, like, patent applications that had been leaked for artificial intelligence stuff. It was an enormously elaborate, clever sort of behind-the-scenes web campaign. Anyway, it was a lot of fun hunting around, and in periods when I had renders going on, that's when I did. So this is an ILM film. Let's get into the visual effects, but start, I guess, by paying homage to honoring the amazing lineup of talent. So we've got, in addition to the ILM crew, which is Dennis Muren and people like Scott Farren, but also Doug Smythe and a ton of other really good people, we had Stan Winston, and I think Stan Winston is, I'm right in saying, I think he actually said that this was the most ambitious film they ever did.
Yeah.
At that. So, killer lineup. I mean, just a really, really great lineup of people. I guess we've started on the character animation, so let's keep going. So, Matt, you liked the beings, but I think you'd agree with me, Teddy was like the standout, wasn't it?
Yeah, Hal Hinkle was the animation soup over at ILM for it, and I found Teddy was just a complete winner. I mean, Most of the CG stuff was predominantly when he was running and doing other shots that the puppeteers just couldn't do. But it was a great team effort trying to replicate the model and puppet of Teddy and then keep it going with the CG. The puppet was really interesting, though, because there are up to 6 puppeteers using him, operating him, including one guy in a walking suit, which... so. A full-grown adult walking behind a very small bear, and the bear mimicking the exact movements and walking of the puppeteer. I thought that was really clever stuff from Stan Winston's studios.
Yeah. Now, you might know this, Matt Walton, but as I understand it, they had to rewrite the render shader at ILM for this. Like, it took about 6 months to redo the first stuff, because they'd done Mighty Joe before this,
right.
But that was kind of straight, dark hair. This was like brown, curly hair. And this is in the days where brown curly hair, 1.5 million of which, was actually quite hard to render.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think Teddy, by far, like both the puppet of Teddy and the CG renderings of Teddy, that I think that is some of the best stuff in the film. I mean, he's a character that is so compelling, and it works on a number of levels. Even the at times, there's a couple wide shots where Teddy's running, and the his... center of gravity seems kind of off, and his contact of his feet on the ground, I think, where he's sort of running up the hill to chase the the moon or whatever. There's a shot where you see him sort of running over the ebb of the hill, and it looks sort of funny. But even that, you know, it's almost something that you can sort of forgive, because the character becomes somebody that, at least for me, it became so compelling to watch. You know what Teddy was going to do, and he has some good kind of, you know. Kind of goofy one-liners in the movie, not for comedy's sake, but just kind of like, you know, it's funny to think of a toy telling a boy, you know, oh, don't do that, or, you know, no, David, or whatever he says a few times.
We run now.
Yeah, exactly. It's
synthetic moral judgment, yeah.
Yeah. And
I thought he was a great character. I actually thought that this idea of the super toys, which, of course, harks back to the original 90s, what is it, 69 story, mm-hmm. Super Toys Last All Summer Long.
Yep.
But that idea of the super toys was just brilliant. And his kind of, every time you'd cut to him and he wasn't meant to be doing anything else, he'd be sitting down with a needle and thread repairing himself. That was just awesome. Yeah, and also I think it gave you an idea that they programmed the boy to have boy-like perspective on the world, and that wasn't the best they could do in terms of artificial intelligence. It's just that they gave him... Was he meant to be 6? How old was he meant to be? 9?
I think 10, how old, right? Or 11.
10, okay. They gave him a 10-year-old's perspective on life rather than just, you know, that's the extent of your artificial intelligence. But yeah, I thought Teddy was awesome. But what do we think of Dr. No and the Blue Fairy?
I didn't like the Blue Fairy myself. I think that comes down to a design thing. It just... I found it jarring, but I understood that it wasn't supposed to be super real. It was supposed to be... yeah, mecha creation of Blue Fairy.
Yeah, and I thought there were a couple shots too of the... I mean, but it's one of those things, like, it's a design problem too. Like, there were a few shots of the Blue Fairy moving at the end of the film, and you see the textures on her arm and stuff, and they just looked real, like, just base procedural textures. They didn't look like, you know, there was a whole lot of love put into that. I don't know that that's the case, but it looked real plasticky, you know. It didn't, or kind of rubber. Yeah. It didn't look like...
They made so many other things look good, so why did they just, you know, go for a really basic Blue Fairy?
Yeah, it didn't seem like it really went as far as it could go. And then I thought Dr. No, you know, it's sort of hard to really have, you know, it's such a character design kind of thing that, you know, I guess it's what he's like, Dr. Freud or Einstein or something, you know.
He reminded me of Mr. DNA from Jurassic Park.
Totally, yeah. It totally had that same kind of feeling right out of the box as soon as he appears, you know.
Yeah, I didn't like Dr. No at the time because I just heard Robin Williams. So I just had a, you know, that's Robin Williams. And unlike the ones that I missed, like Meryl Streep and Chris Rock and everybody else, I was definitely like, well, that's the voice of Robin Williams.
They actually recorded Robin Williams when Kubrick was still alive and looking at directing it. So
I really,
yeah, I read that too, and I thought that was so surprised. Same with Chris Rock. That was recorded by Stanley Kubrick while he was still...
I didn't know that.
Working on the project, which is amazing to me.
Huh. Well, that is interesting. So, okay, so if that's the character animation, let's move on to the visual effects. And I think we just got to take it in three acts, because there is really obviously these distinctive three acts. So let's start with the visual effects in Act 1. And I guess one of the ones that I thought of the time worked extraordinarily well was the face falling on the spinach eating, the trick of basically taking a Photoshop image of his face and producing this great, you know, image of a collapsed face and then tracking it back on. Because I've got to say, given that we didn't have subsurface scattering and stuff back then, any other approach I think would have looked completely fake. But I thought that worked really well. Oh, obviously, it's really sort of limited camera moves, but who cares?
Yeah, no, I agree. I thought that was a really strong shot. I also think, too, in Act 1, the sort of the opening scene where you've got, who is it, William Hurt or whatever, as the sort of Geppetto or Dr. Hobby or whatever his name is at the beginning, and the female character who I can't remember her name, but the mecha,
Sheila,
that's sitting there, and how her face sort of detaches and opens up, and he pulls out the little, you know, the cube out of her brain or whatever. And I think some of that worked really well. It's one of those things, like the transition from the real actress to the CG. It was dealing with that seam, and then having the seam disappear sort of at the on the forehead, and I think just below the nose. It's one of those things that it's hard to see how that would work, you know, as a design thing. Like it closes and opens almost, you know, magically, right? And I guess it works in the split second that you see it, but it's probably the one thing out of that shot that was, for me, problematic, but it's minor.
It's pretty good.
Yeah, that's the thing, is it's minor, I think. But I think it's a design thing, too, right? Like, it gets back to that same issue. Like, how would you resolve that? Like, I don't know. I guess it seemed unreal that it would open that way in some ways, but, you know.
But at the time, it was a, you know, promo trailer shot of, like, wowness, wasn't
it? Totally,
It was pretty cool. It was a nice break from the laborious exposition of that scene. It's like, why is the guy telling the room full of people what they're doing when they already know it?
Yeah, it's true.
So having a simple little thing like that, which was just, it was subtle. It wasn't a, hey, look at this chick's head explode and show you this cube in her head. It was like, nice little.
I do just say, though, like, even the exposition at the beginning, like, I do really enjoy, and I did really enjoy all of those questions that are asked about, you know, and then that are explored throughout that first act, like, just thematically dealing with that issue of, like, well, what does that mean? What does it mean? Like, there's all those studies that were done back in the, you know, in the 70s and 80s where they're, and I think there's a documentary film coming out about this, too, where they would take, like, a chimpanzee, right, and they made this like metallic mother, right, and they did this experiment where they gave the chimpanzee to this metallic mother, and the chimpanzee never really bonded with it and became really despondent, right, and even though it could feed the baby chimp, like, and give it milk or whatever, it never really connected with it. And then they took the same sort of mechanized mother and covered it in cloth, you know, and they put cloth on it and it could feed the chimp, and the chimp was really connected to it and would hug it and hold it and go to it for comfort and all that kind of stuff. And I thought there was something so interesting about the development of the characterization between the mother and the son, and the exploration of that idea about, like, what does it mean for something to appear to have feelings, like to seem to be programmed to have feelings and to trigger emotional responses in us, in humans. You know, I think exploring those ideas was really interesting, and the exposition of that exploration, both at the beginning and the positing of that question, and then the way it's executed throughout the narrative, was something, at least for me, I love those ideas. You know, it's like the
good science fiction,
great science fiction, for sure.
I like the fact that we've talked about Kubrick, but sort of Steven Spielberg wrote this, and I think you're right. Like, there's a lot of intelligent stuff in there that didn't get cut and didn't get dumbed down. And I agree. I thought the whole change of expression from, and the whole thing from Monica to Mummy after the 7-word imprinting.
Yeah.
I thought all of that was really well done and was played out with an adequate amount of time, but not too much. And yeah, no, I mean, from that point of view, I thought it was really, really good. And I liked, I mean, apart from that point we raised about the set, I liked that first act for for exploring those things. And obviously, you know, how tormented the mother was by trying to deal with having this sort of artificial boy and yet didn't need anything. And, you know, it was a difficult problem. And I felt for the child, quite frankly, when he was at the bottom of the swimming pool after the incident with the brother. Yeah. I mean, I really...
Well, and what's up with the father, too? That was the one... He was a problematic character in the script and the way that he was dealt with. Like, and I think he really encourages her to, like, take this thing on. And then he sort of, you know, the second he feels threatened by this thing, and he, you know, he almost has this like classic kind of jealousy of it too, in a way. The second he feels threatened by it or feels like it's a threat to his family, like he just turns and is like, no, we got to destroy it. You know, I don't know. His character was so, there was not much to that character. He was so simple.
But getting back to the visual effects, we're talking about 350 shots in this split between Dennis Muren, who really took the third act, and Scott Farr, who did those first two acts. And a lot of stuff became, of course, much more interesting once they left the house. We get into the second act. So in the second act, we have a lot of really good stuff, from physical effects right through to sort of straight computer visual effects. Now, Matt, you did a bit of hunting around on the practical side of things and what happened when they got to the Flesh Fair. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, the Flesh Fair, I thought, was great for the use of the puppets. So there was up to 46 puppeteers and engineers working on that set. And so much of that is practical in-camera stuff, like them being fired from the cannons is, you know, these puppets, fiberglass bodies being pulled on wires from the cannons through the rotating fans with a live band on stage and, you know, hundreds of extras and all that kind of stuff. So it's pretty ballsy to have a bit of a risk of doing it live action. But, you know, all the other, a lot of the robots, it was a big mix of, you know, they used some amputees as actors and then augmented them with, you know, falling robot parts and things like that. But two of the main standout robots for me, I can't believe they were actually 100% puppets. The one with the floating head and having the face projected within the little glass dome.
The retro one, the old
one?
Yeah.
I thought that would have been a comp for the face, but that was just a little projection inside the practical, which I was impressed with. And, the other one that was, I can't remember what the puppet's name was, but the one that was modeled to look like Stan Winston. I thought both of those, he was the one with the super gangly arms, and I think ends up getting his arms, legs, and head ripped off. But the puppeteering of all those characters was just absolutely awesome.
Yeah, no, I think the Flesh Fair was good. I mean, it was pretty upsettingly violent. I don't know, I totally believe that the audience turned on one scream from the child, but, you know, from a visual effects point of view, yeah, I thought it was really great, really had echoes almost of the cantina from Star Wars, right? Like where you suddenly go from, you know, he's out on the farm to discovering all these aliens.
And hadn't thought about that, but yeah, with Ministry playing on stage. Yeah.
Exactly. And there's not only the Flesh farm stuff, all that stuff that where they're ripping them apart, but of course you have the Rogue City stuff, the Rouge City stuff, I should say, which was a huge set extension. And interestingly, as you may have seen if anyone's watched the DVD extras on this, or even I think read in Cinefix, there's a revolutionary kind of stage of previs or on-set visualization that we've discussed from other points of view, right through to things like Avatar, but they had unique barcoded markers on all of the sections of the roof of the studio for that, and so literally Steven Spielberg could sit there and line up a camera with the live-action actors and have a low poly count previs comp of what was happening on the background behind him, and that was revolutionary in its day, and certainly would have helped tremendously in framing up that sequence. Matt Walden, did you like the Rouge City kind of neon fest?
Yeah, I mean, I think there were elements of it that seemed to be sort of, you know, Kubrick inspired in terms of the designs of some of the buildings, like the you know, going into the mouth of the bridge coming across, and then a couple of.
Did you notice who was in the car in that going into the mouth thing? That was Vince from Entourage.
Oh, yeah.
And he had an Entourage back then. Wow. That guy just hangs with his buds.
He's keeping it real.
Sorry,
man.
Go on.
No, yeah. But yeah, I thought that stuff, you know, was kind of cool. It worked pretty good. I couldn't help but think, though, as I was watching this, and I, I kept thinking, like, God, it would be so interesting, you know, in an alternate reality to be able to see, you know, if Stanley Kubrick had made this film, what would be different? Like, and I think both of the Flesh Fair and the Rouge City elements are really interesting. And, you know, there are definitely elements of both that are, I think are appropriately provocative and disturbing. But I mean, just imagining somebody like Stanley Kubrick, if you go back and watch any Kubrick film, he doesn't have really a single sentimental scene in any of his movies. I can't think of one, really.
As A Clockwork Orange had quite a lot of sentimental scenes, really, you know, during the rape sequence.
And yeah. And I mean, it would be interesting to see, I mean, something like the idea of, you know, a city like that, like a city that's sort of geared towards, you know, people's pleasure, like kind of a sexual Las Vegas or something. The idea of what that would mean and the kinds of, I think, probably very disturbing and real perversions that people would exploit in that kind of environment. You know, it felt like it was kind of a Rudy Giuliani version of Rouge City.
It felt very clean.
Yeah.
Yeah, very clean kind of.
Yeah, I think though that it's a Spielberg kind of film at the right. end of the day.
Like, well, I guess that's what I'm saying. I think, like, you know, that it, I think it works, you know, but
got
I think
the
it's
E.T. in place of the Clockwork Orange.
Yeah, it's like it's still, it scored its PG-13 rating, right? I think in it kept it in a certain arena that was interesting, but one that I would say probably was maybe less believable. It seemed less real, right? It's a fairy tale, and it fulfilled its fairy tale mission.
Now, what do we think of Gigolo Joe, and for that matter, David, and the whole face thing? Because the actors had, even the 10-year-old, had his face completely shaved, and they had, like, a lot of makeup applied to sort of give them a less realistic skin texture, as opposed to going with some kind of artificial VFX solution to the faces of, and yeah. I thought that was a great way to go.
I thought so too, and I just was going to tell you guys, I had a chance to call up an old friend of mine, Ned Gorman, who is a visual effects producer, and he was at ILM for 22 years, and he was just recently down in LA at DD working on Transformers 3, but he's back in Sausalito now. But I talked to him on the phone for a while the other day, just sort of catching up. He was one of my sponsors for the VES, and and talking with Ned was really fun because he was telling me stories. I had this vague memory of seeing him in one of the buildings at ILM, and, you know, stopping and talking with him in the hallway, and way back in, you know, the early 90s, and he was saying that he was heading over to London with Dennis Muren, and they were going to meet with Stanley Kubrick, and this was in 1993. It was right after Jurassic Park had been released, and Dennis was invited by Stanley Kubrick to come over and talk about AI. It was like Thanksgiving weekend or something, and Ned told me that he, you know, Dennis told him about it, and Ned just said, like, well, I'm coming with you.
And I guess you would.
You know, yeah, you Jim would. Jim he told me Jim Morris at the time had said, like, well, yeah, you should go. And so they went
That's
over
Jim Morris, who was then head of ILM, right?
Yeah,
now Pixar,
correct.
Right?
And so Ned went with him, and they flew over and he said they got in the morning, I think, and they rested, and they went over to Kubrick's house at St. Alban's, I guess he said, at about 6 o'clock at night, and Phil Hobbs was there, and Jan Harlan, and Leon Vitelli, and a couple other characters, I guess, that were part of Kubrick's crew. And they got there at 6 p.m., and Kubrick had prepared this whole, like, Thanksgiving meal for them, and they actually stayed up and talked until 7 a.m. the next morning, that Kubrick actually was staying on, like, North American time or something, you know, in order to, like, have this meeting with them. And they talked about the project for a long time, and Ned was telling me that who, by the way, just, you know, anecdotally, Ned Gorman, you know, is really, you guys can look him up on IMDb. He's just a great, great guy and a really great producer with, like, a long and very illustrious career in the business, but a really great guy. But he said that Stanley grilled Dennis and him for about 12 hours on just what was possible, and they got to see some of the production art that had been that was being worked on at the time. They talked some about the script, and he was saying that one of the things that I thought was kind of interesting was that Kubrick wasn't worried at all about any of the environments or the ideas or any miniatures or anything like that. But what he was really worried about was the character of David. And one of the things that Ned had said, getting to what you were talking about with the makeup, was that he wanted it to look like a fluid, living, mechanical porcelain doll. And so they had explored all kinds of possibilities of what that would be. And for a long time, they'd wanted to do a CG character. Or he was proposing the idea of doing a CG character, which I think would have been really difficult to do in 2001, because Ned said he'd asked him, well, how many shots are you thinking the kid would be in? And he's like, well, he'd be in every shot in the movie. So you're looking at like 1,500 plus shots. And he's like, well, you know, you're looking at something that really hasn't been done at that point, hadn't been done to date, doing something CG with that many shots in it. And, you know, it's probably cost prohibitive and stuff. And so they started looking at other things that they could do. And Ty Ellingson, who we've had on the show once before, he, when Ned and Dennis came back, Ty did a couple designs. And I remember they were exploring all kinds of possibilities. And Ty was talking about this, too. They were exploring all kinds of possibilities of what they could do to make the character of David look like a robot. And so they were exploring all kinds of things, like doing stuff with the eyes, like having some sort of like a fine, somewhat visible mesh, like within the pupil, like sort of set back inside the pupil of a real actor.
Like a contact thing or a contact solution, or is doing it in post?
I think it was they were exploring doing something like that in post. I'm not certain, though. And then the other one that they were exploring, which sounded really interesting to me, was they were going to take the character and give him abnormally large eyes. So they were going to make his eyes, you know, three or four times bigger than they would normally be. So he'd have these huge eyes in the front, which would have, I think, been really interesting and potentially kind of
expensive. Well, Mad Hatter from Alice in Wonderland.
Yeah, exactly. And but yeah, and I thought I just thought that was really interesting hearing some of that feedback from Ned, and the idea that that was something really early on, was this idea of creating a sort of fluid living mechanical porcelain doll was sort of the goal. And I think the makeup that they used and the idea that they shaved all the, like, you know, probably on the kid it was probably like, you know, peach fuzz kind of hair on his arms and all the stuff on his face and stuff, they shaved all that off and did the same thing with Jude Law, and they had that real waxy, shiny look. It felt like it faded some over time on the boy, that his and it maybe was a conceit too, like to try to embody a more human like persona to him, but he seemed waxier at the beginning of the film than he did towards the end, I thought.
Yeah.
They also had this sort of symmetrical gum veneer thing that they put in their mouths to make their and I think fake teeth in the case of Gigolo Joe. Does anyone know about that?
No, I know Gigolo Joe had a prosthetic chin, which they added just to give it more of a squarey look. And to get his hair looking so perfect and molded, once they did his hair, they'd then put a face mask on him and spray paint like a outline around to give a permanent edge to make it look more like a Lego Man kind of head.
I thought the PDI hair morph when he changes his hair colour to blonde was really good. PDI obviously did the Michael Jackson black or white kind of stuff, but apparently they did a 3D scan of the head and then produced 3D mats to do that morph between the hair you're talking about, Matt, the, you know, sort of plastic toy hair and the blonde hair that he went to.
Anyone
else like that?
His Devo hair, yeah. I thought it was great. Yeah, totally worked. I mean, I think all that kind of stuff, you know, the kind of gimmicky, you know, it felt real vaudevillian, I think intentionally so, but like, you know, the actors, you know, the tick of the head to start the kind of tinny sounding music.
Did that very
and,
well.
But all that stuff was great. I mean, it was really fun, and he, you know, his sort of dance moves, and he became a really fun sort of comic relief kind of character. And it really did start to feel kind of Wizard of Oz-like, too, at that point in the film, which I think is also probably another touchstone film that's sort of being, you know, tapped into a little bit here in this film. But I think he really brought a lot to it. And I think all those touches of, yeah, the PDI hair morph, I mean, I just thought that looked great. It was really nice.
I was less impressed, I must say, in Rouge City with the helicopter takeoff sequence, because they'd done it with a motion control rig that had a rod up from the basically the floor of the set. And so when the helicopter was taking off, it was, you know, a physical thing that was moving on a rod. It felt like it was fake. And I sort of analysed it, because as we, anyone that listens to the show regularly knows, I think we've got to really, if we don't like something, say why. And I looked at it over and over again, and I realised what it was for me was that the high-frequency judder that you got from having a prop on a rod, which was a prop big enough to obviously hold two characters, the high-frequency judder tended to emanate, it looked from below, not from above. Like, I felt like a chopper should have a different vibration signature. It didn't look like... A chopper doesn't wobble. A chopper vibrates from the blade action. And right. So the swaying that you get to... oversimplify this problem, and the high frequency kind of jitter that you got from it sort of bumping into things and just jittering around didn't feel like the because of course its center of rotation is a fixed point about what, 3 feet below it, not a center of rotation 2 feet above it, or if that makes sense. And so I don't know about you guys, but I just thought that the helicopter didn't feel like it was flying when it was taking off. It felt like it was traveling along and either on a rod or on a wheels or on a something. But it just, for all the effort they went into for that takeoff sequence, I thought the chopper escape didn't, from a practical or visual effects point of view, work particularly well. What do you think, Matt?
Again, I just felt that city thing was very enclosed, so it didn't really help the idea of disbelieving that we were in a fake chopper and a fake soundstage. It wasn't until the chopper actually left the city and then they had some nice environments on the way to New York. That's when I started believing it. But yeah, in the city, I didn't buy it at all.
We've got a little bit more to discuss before I'm going to discuss my favorite bit of the whole film. And that's when he gets to to Manhattan. And I think there are some shots there when he gets to to meet his other doubles, as it were, that were spectacular. I thought one that really just stood... Oh, sorry, before I do that, I also missed... I thought some of the work with the hologram, even though I didn't particularly like Dr. No, the hologram, when they had shots through the hologram at them sitting looking at the hologram, there was some stuff where they, you had distortion through the glasses and stuff that I thought was a nice touch.
That was
cool.
Yeah, that was good.
So that was well composited. But anyway, so they get to Manhattan and he meets his doubles. And I thought the shot where he walks up and he sees through the eyes of the shell of his other face. So it's a shot from the front looking at an eyeless version of himself. And he walks up and we see his real eyes through the mask, if you like, of a perfect version of him. Was just a cracker of a shot.
Yeah.
I mean, it just had that, oh my God, I wish I'd thought of that.
It makes you
prudent.
Think.
Sorry?
It makes you think. it's such a strong symbol for, you know, everything else that the film is talking about.
Yeah, I mean, some of the hanging up sort of dummies didn't look, you know, particularly great, I guess. But that shot was sort of worth it. I mean, did anyone else enjoy that sequence?
Yeah. I mean, it made me think of something, too, that we haven't mentioned yet, which was... To me, this was one of the first... In, I guess, a series of films. I know he worked with this DP. Is it Janusz Kaminski or Janusz Kaminski?
Yep.
I don't know how you say his first name, but if it's a silent J. But I know he's worked with him in the past, and I know he continues to work with him as a DP. But I was sort of fascinated with the look of this film from a cinematography point of view at the get-go, too, which I think influences a lot of the visual effect shots as well, in that it felt like there was stylistically, there was a departure from the look and feel of some of their previous collaborations as director and DP, in that it felt like they went for something that had a different look altogether, that was very much about backlight and having light come, you know, directly into the camera, right? And without so you had these huge flares and stuff that would come across the screen. And I remember when this was in the theater, I remember thinking, wow, this really has a very different texture and look and feel to it visually, not just in terms of the overall design, but I mean in the cinematography and the lighting, which I think really is accentuated in some of those scenes. Both in the house and then even when they're driving in the, which I hated the design of those ridiculous cars. I thought they were so absurd. It was like, but I did feel like, a lot of that stuff, the look, I don't know, it was, I, What did you think of that stuff, Mike, just from a cinematographer's point of view?
Yeah, the fact that every time, not every time, but when we saw David, he had this circular halo of light around him, being at a, whatever it was, like the moon itself, that balloon. But there was also just lights in his bedroom, lights in the kitchen, lights anywhere. You'd get them behind David's head, kind of giving him this halo of light. No, it was just
But do you remember
gorgeous.
When you saw that in the theater? I don't know would you concur? I mean, I felt like I hadn't seen
that
before.
I totally did it on when that moon came up, and, you know, the moon rising, and when they were at the sort of junkyard, as it were, and it was a graveyard of robot parts. The moon was coming up, and you realized it was the blimp floating, and then you just got into this incredibly visceral lighting setup and glare thing at the fair, and, you know, quite frankly, the lighting at the house had such a just departure from other stuff to give it this three act structure.
Well, and then in Minority Report, you know, the next sort of sci fi film that both Spielberg directs and Comiskey shoots, it has this very similar.
And yet much more desaturated and much more almost predictably blue-green palette. That was a more... I agree with you, there were similarities, but from a color palette point of view, it was a drastically reduced saturation
film.
Just cooler,
than
so much
was
cooler, and so much more sort of obviously of its era.
Yeah.
I think Minority Report, I don't know what you think, Matt, but I think Minority Report dates from a color grading point of view much more than AI grades dates from a color grading point of view.
Probably because it was so successful. You know, if everyone likes a look of something, everyone copies and pastes across so many other films. I don't think there's too many people running out to copy and paste all the neon and stuff happening in artificial intelligence. But, I mean, the colour palette later on when we go underneath the water, I thought was beautiful. And all those miniatures were, again, backlit, just so you could grab glimpses of that.
So, okay, so that's my...
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, I'm going to say that you're absolutely right. That's my treasure trove of my secret kind of love of this film is all that underwater stuff. No, I totally agree with you. I think the lighting under the water, that is, of course, now Kerner Optical, was then ILM's miniatures model department, but that is just a standout sequence. I mean, there is... I don't know about you guys. I reckon you can't fault that. Once it goes under the water... for just sheer storytelling, almost entirely visual effects, a vibe. I mean, okay, yeah, it's stylized and, you know, would all these things have not somehow got affected by the water coming in to flood the area? But who cares? Like, once you say that that's what you want from a directorial point of view, the execution of that by Kerner Optical, just gorgeous. That's all miniatures, pretty much, except for, of course, they then put particulates in the water and sort of reeds and things floating by to give it the. But it's all dry for wet. And
yeah, that was cool.
Yeah, and that was Pat Sweeney too. Who he's like the he's still a Kerner, I believe, but he's like the VFX DP, and he's been like motion control guru at ILM forever. And Pat Sweeney is just like an amazingly gifted cinematographer, especially of miniatures, and that stuff is just so great. That was my note too. My favorite things in the film had to be both Teddy, and I love the stuff at the end. I think, you know, the third act, that world under the water is just totally amazing looking.
Let's go to the third act now. This is now pretty much Dennis Muren. Okay, you're gonna excuse me for this, but I'm gonna tell an anecdote that just showing off now. I was at ILM. Just a few weeks ago, and I had my Epic our Epic camera there, and we were shooting the optical printer, which we're going to do some work on. You'll be glad to know, Matt.
It's cool.
Anyway, so we're shooting the optical printer with the Epic, and out walks Dennis Muren, and Dennis hadn't played with the Epic, so I'm there showing Dennis the Epic, and I literally lost it at one point. I was like, I can't believe I'm telling you something about cameras. I mean, it was just like, you know, and I'm not a short guy, but Dennis is like just a bit taller than
really
me.
He's really tall.
And when I say a bit taller, I mean like about 300 miles taller than me.
Yeah.
And, it was... I mean, I'd met him before, obviously, but just showing him cameras at ILM, standing next to an optical printer, there was just some kind of collision.
Well, and standing next to that optical printer, too, which has seen had seen
the
so much action.
Printer,
and now
yeah.
And now it's sitting like in that glass case, like a sort of a museum piece. I mean, it's beautiful to see it, but, I mean, it's one of those things that, you know, that's a really neat moment. That's so cool.
Yeah, it was just, you know, one of those things where you come home at the end of the night, you have a, as I did, a tequila sitting in a bar and go, okay, that was a good day. anyway, you'll excuse me for indulging that.
That's a great story.
Dennis Muren, obviously, we're not worthy kind of visual effects guy, but the nicest, most humble, genuinely down-to-earth guy you could possibly meet. So he's helming this for ILM for the last act, and we've discussed, obviously, the character animation from it. But let's discuss that idea of the sort of ice section of it, as it were, because the house bit we've kind of covered with the angel, the blue fairy and the beings. I love the ship design. I love the design of the cubic kind of transport device that the beings or the sort of Uber mechas travel around in. And I thought, interestingly, there's lots of self-referential stuff in this film we haven't really touched on, like the box in the head at the very beginning, I'm sure was connected to the box at the end that they're traveling in. And the logo of the Cybernetics or Cyber... was it Cybertronics Inc.? With that kind of very thin... that he described as being a bird with feathers when he was trying to draw it, is a sort of prelude to the shape of the beings when they do appear. There's a lot of self-referential stuff. As I say, I would have liked even more of that. But I thought that the ice discovery of David, the flying around Manhattan being excavated in ice, was all just, for the 2001, really well handled. Matt, what did you think? Matt Walden?
Yeah, no, I would totally agree. I love that idea of sort of the archaeological dig, you know, that's going on where they've gone through and so, with whatever technology they have, they're sort of digging out bits and pieces of the city and coming across these various nuggets of the society that had been there 2,000 years prior. And I thought all of that stuff worked great. And, you know, it's funny you mentioned that about the statue and about the beings at the end, because that's something that I think subconsciously, yeah, of course, now you say that, I'm like, oh, of course. And it made me think even the opening shot when we first see David, when he first comes to the house in Act 1.
Oh, exactly.
He's in sort of a bokeh or whatever, where he's all sort of soft. Yeah. And he has that same form. And it's such a neat trick, and you know, it really I think now that you mention that, that makes that shot stood out for me watching it again. And I remember seeing it the first time and being like, oh, that's so weird, like how he's so soft and his neck looks elongated, and as he walks closer he comes into the focal plane. But I thought that was so that's so interesting that you say that, because it really it clearly now that was so intentional, you know, and I didn't see that originally until you just said that. But yeah, all that stuff at the end, I love the design of that fly through, kind of going through sort of the, you know, almost like flying through a trench or dug out of ice, and you see the, what do you see, like the Chrysler building and dug
Matt,
out.
In you'd know this being an American. Is that the World Trade Center that was as part of the miniature setup in that sequence flying in?
It is, yeah. And they they talked about that in some of the materials that Todd Skolton put together for us. I hadn't known that before, but that this movie came out not long before 9/11, I guess, within it, during the, in the same year anyway, but before that had taken place. And I guess there was some note in there that said that there was some, you know, controversy, like whether or not, you know, was Spielberg going to go back and revisit that and remove the Twin Towers, and he just decided not to, which I applaud him for. I think it's ridiculous to go back and make changes like that. But yeah, no, those are definitely the Twin Towers, both that you see sticking up out of the water at the beginning of that Act 3.
By the way, that water stuff, the obviously, you know, ILM had done Perfect Storm in 2000, so that water stuff pre the jump 2,000 years I thought was great. The miniatures were great, especially the lions that weep. And I've actually seen one of those lions that weep at Canoptical, the statues. But the I've got to say, the post-jump ice stuff had a really good ice shader, I thought, on all snow shader. Like, it's kind of hard to do that white stuff and not just, you know, become a fairly featureless barren nothingness. Doing a good ice shader or a snow shader, I think, is actually a lot harder than most people would give it credit
is
for,
all
because
that
you
stuff,
just don't have a lot of detail.
Is it all CG that's the, or is that part miniature that they fly through?
I know the buildings, the wrecked New Manhattan, there were lots of miniatures for those.
Yeah.
And I assumed some of those had been used as elements for the CG, but perhaps not. I mean, that move, that flying around move thing, felt like you would do that CG, but I think a lot of the ice and snow stuff, and Yeah, and I mean, obviously there was practical stuff as well, right down to, you know, scraping ice off the windshield kind of stuff of the... I've been calling it a helicopter, but it actually had a name in the film, didn't it? It was like a heli-submersible or something. Please email us if you know what the name of the win a free T-shirt. No, but yeah, it was... And I thought that... look, as I said, I don't think that the strongest character animation was the animation of the Uber Mechas, but I thought that, as Matt picked up, they did have their work cut out for them, not having a face to really animate much on.
Well, and there was that cool thing that they did, too, with the, that I thought was kind of neat in the close-up of sort of the Ben Kingsley Uber Mech when he's speaking. There's that, like, ring sort of in his neck that's kind of pulsing with the... his voice, you know, and I thought that was kind of a cool, and it was sort of subdermal, right? It was like inside the neck under, you know, and you saw this sort of like...
Well, also when they were doing the shoulder-on-shoulder touching to transmit the experience.
That was a bit much for me.
Oh, you didn't like that?
No, not so much. It's like in Minority Report when, again, they get a disc out to move files from one side of the room to the other.
I mean, don't they have network? They don't have like an 802.11n network connecting them together or something?
Yeah, I mean...
they're not wireless? Come on, man.
Even if they're mechas or aliens, they've got technology to make sheets of metal fly apart and then fly around in them, so why not have Bluetooth or something?
But I mean, I think it was, again, I think it's probably, you know, it's one of those things that, right, it's like it's a performance-based story conceit where it's like, it's another way of exposition, right, where he's having them actually touch one another to convey that they're communicating, because there is no other way to really convey that other than, you know, having their faces light up, which I, you know.
There was some movie that that was before this is a complete rat hole, where... They stored emotions. Do you guys remember this? It was a sci-fi film, and you could record it. It was set in the modern day. You could actually record your emotional experience and then play it back to somebody. And it was like a film from the 70s or 80s. God, what is
Brainstorm?
It was like, yeah, it might have been Brainstorm. And I remember at the end of the film, somebody wanted to experience something, and they plugged in a acoustic coupler modem to transfer the data, which was like, you know, you could hardly get text characters down, and they were going to transfer an entire emotional experience that was gigabytes.
It had to be the dumbest person in the world to get an experience out of a 56.
Well, that or the end of War Games, when the software crashes and causes all the computers to blow up.
Oh yeah,
I'm going to build my computer so that if it crashes, it actually ignites and has flames coming out of it. Let's have a explosive charge that, should the computer crash, will detonate the doors. Anyway, yeah, so computers in films is my pet hate. But anyway, this film actually got off pretty well. There was not much of tech dating. You know what I mean? Like, for a tech film, this film could easily, 10 years on, 12 years on... we were going to try and do this episode, just so you know, on the 7th of March to be... anniversary of Kubrick's death, but I failed miserably to get stay on schedule. But yeah, here we are. You know,
the only thing dating it was there was the use of the Harman Kardon subwoofer speaker. I don't know if you noticed that in the
as one of the buildings.
I didn't see that. And in the lab, there was like four of them sitting around all the like Dave.
Oh, really? Oh yeah.
All the Davids on meat hooks. You know, I was like, hey, I have that subwoofer.
I thought the money actually dated it. In the future, we'll use smaller money, but still coins.
Right.
I just thought that was kind of odd.
Yeah, that's a good point, actually. I thought of that. I mean, it's really hard, isn't it? Like, you pick a technology and you think it's going to make complete sense, and then it just goes completely left to field. Actually, the best thing of that ever was one of the Star Trek films where he walked up and saw a computer from the current era. I think it was like 4, and he goes, it's not working. Voice activated. Hello, computer, it's not working. He goes, and points at the mouse, and goes, of course, picks up the mouse and tries using it as a microphone. Hello, computer. sorry, I don't know why I'm going off on tangent today. So anyway, let's get back to AI, and I'm going to behave myself. So I think we pretty much covered it. Is there anything we haven't covered in the film?
The only other shot I wanted to mention that is, it's in the scene with the flesh fair, is the nanny bot, who had the floating face and the floating ponytails behind her, which I thought was, you know, there's one shot in particular where she kind of runs up to camera and you see her from the front, and it's a really long, just total hero VFX shot, great composite, great animation, like, and she turns to the side and you see that, like, it's just basically, you know, the face plate, and it's all negative space in between, and then she runs, you know, and goes back into the shed or whatever where they all get caught. But
that, I think that was at, yeah, that was at the junking stage where they sort of the graveyard of dumped.
Yeah, yeah, past. Before they get picked up to and taken to the fair or whatever.
You're right, yeah.
But I thought that was really just such a great shot, and it's one that, you know, the people working on that one, I think, you know, even, you know, now that it's been however many years since this movie came out, you know, should be applauded. That was a great great effect, and I know
it was
that,
impactful. Yeah, wasn't it? It was,
yeah, good. And it was one that, like, you know, ILM, I'm sure, had that on their reel, you know, for for those you know, a few years afterwards, I'm sure.
Yeah, that reel must be pretty bloody hard to get on, don't you think?
I would say so by now, yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Matt, is there anything for you that we didn't cover?
No, I mean, I just loved how so much of it was prac. It really swung from being prac at the beginning of the film to 100% CG at the end.
And I just want to put a correction in. I just looked it up while we were talking. That ice stuff, a lot of that was, in fact, 13th scale miniatures. Yeah, that was done because Donut Spoon wanted a lot of depth to it, and they used
that. That's why those shaders look so good.
Yeah.
That's why they look so bloody good. Yeah. I mean, now look, let's just discuss it in wrapping up with, like, how strong would this film have been had they gone down a much more CG route, and I just think it would have been a flop. I just don't think that, no matter how great everyone involved was, that this film would have been as good had Stan Winston's team not been there and they'd just done a heck of a lot more CG characters in 2001. I think this was a classic, beautiful mixture of practical and visual effects. You guys must agree with me, yeah?
Yeah, definitely. I would totally agree. And I, the other thing I thought that was really interesting, just reading up on this film, is that it had an incredibly accelerated shooting schedule for a film.
I did it
of this length and of this complexity too. Yeah, I think it was said it was total
67 days or something.
Yeah, which seems crazy fast for a movie of this scale to me. I don't know.
If it was Kubrick, it definitely would have taken a bit longer, I think.
Yeah,
400
no
takes just to
and be grittier.
Yeah. Do you know how long it was in post? I mean, it's 350 shots, but some pretty killer shots. Was it accelerated in post as well?
I don't know. I have some vague recollection that was the case, but I can't confirm that that's correct or not.
We haven't really seen Haley do a lot more since he was the go-to guy for being a kid, have we? He must be about, what, 18 now or something?
Like, he does a lot of voices for games and cartoons and stuff.
He was born in 88, right? So, okay, so 23-ish. Yeah. Okay. Well, I hope we see him again.
Yeah, he was great. I mean, he held the movie together. I think he was great in the film.
Yeah, I mean, totally. The idea of not doing the blinking, which has been widely reported and contributed so much to the robotic differentiation, just made him both appealing and eerie, and was brilliant. And obviously, he did a bunch of really good films, Sixth Sense being, you know, a standout amongst them. But, yeah, I hope we'll see him now he's older in something else. No doubt he'll come back as the hunky doctor in some kind of romantic comedy.
He's thing. Sort of the Edward Furlong of the Spielberg of the Spielberg films, maybe, you know.
And also, obviously, Gigolo Joe, just standout performance as well, like just really not trying to steal the film and totally nailing it for a character. So a lot of really good performances from the actors, which of course goes an incredibly long way in this mixture. And I think, just on that point about the Stan Winston guys, I think it must have helped for those actors to have the amount of physical puppetry and actual practical stuff on set to react to and look to and work with. I think it is really hard on actors today, especially young actors that are, you know, meant to be playing 10-year-olds, to be able to deliver a performance to green screen the way these actors did to practical kind of things on set. And you only have to watch it, anyone that's ever you know, obviously untrained actor, a sports star or whatever, that's been on a Muppets show. And you can see how they start reacting to the Muppets like they're real things. And I think it's a really huge aspect of visual effects that we just, you know, as much as I love computer graphics and everything else, we just got to, you know, concede that it's pretty hard for the actors to nail it when they're performing to nothing. So, look, I like this film. As I said, I think it's a bit of a make or masterpiece. I think it's certainly better now than I remembered it. I enjoy it more now than I remember enjoying it back in the day. So if you haven't seen it in a while, I recommend that you get it and look for some of those self-referential things that that Matt is going to have to now go back and study up himself. Matt, if people want to contact you or follow you or check you out or see what you're doing other than your IMDb page, where's a good place to go?
You can find me on Twitter at Matt Wallen or at mattwallen.com.
And Matt Graham, you obviously, as we've said in the past, not really a Twitterer.
Not so much a Twitterer. I did actually start a Twitter account the other day, but I don't know if I'll ever use it. So
it's probably not a good,
don't follow me
not
there.
A good advertisement to follow. But what is your Twitter?
It is Matt_Graham78. But otherwise, I
have there 78 other Matt Grahams, or are you celebrating something else?
The year I was born, and it's just such a cool number to wear on the back of T-shirts in American films, apparently. So,
okay.
But otherwise, I'm over at www.talkingloud.com, which is me just crapping on about films with some friends while drinking red wine.
Excellent.
Excellent. Of course, you'll find me at FX Guide and Mike Seymour on Twitter. And we just want to thank Todd Shilton for being our producer, does our research, and tries to basically... Well, I think Todd's main problem in life is trying to... solve my availability, poor guy. He does an incredibly good job organising the shows as well as researching them. And of course, we have in person Matt Graham to say thank you, who does most of the editing on the show. So thank you, Matt.
Pleasure.
Gentlemen, we run now. Talk to you next week. Bye.
If you have any questions or comments, please email us at vfx@fxguide.com. Copyright 2011, FX Guide, LLC.